The subject of justice can be a thorny one pretty much anywhere in the country. It gets further complicated on tribal lands across America. Who is responsible for security and justice can be very different from place to place, depending upon federal laws and more. The federal Supreme Court ruling last spring on a case involving tribal justice, the Supreme Court ruled last spring on a case involving tribal justice. That was Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. The Yurok tribe filed a brief on behalf of Castro Huerta, which ended up being the losing side. The Yuroks have a robust justice system of their own. We'll explore that and the more general issue of justice on tribal lands. Our guests are Judge Abby Abinanti, the Yurok Chief Justice. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Dawn Baum is with us as well, the Director of the Yurok Tribal Attorney. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. We also have with us Greg Oblovsky, who's a law professor at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay. Good to have you all here. Judge Abby, start with you, please, because a lot of this comes back to crimes against missing and murdered Indigenous women. The Yurok tribe weighed in on this late last year. Talk about that.
Well, as many people are aware, we have a severe problem throughout the country with missing and murdered Native people. And we have been working very hard to gather information as a sort of precursor to setting up a protocol internally that will help us interact with our neighboring jurisdictions to, one, prevent the problem, and two, look at trying to solve some of the cases that are ongoing, meaning cold cases primarily.
And the tribe did declare an emergency in December of last year, is that right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is easy to get confused outside the reservation about the state of affairs with law enforcement jurisdiction on it. Dawn Baum, set us up with what the situation is for the Yuroks.
So the situation on the Yurok Reservation today is the tribe, of course, has jurisdiction over crimes committed on the reservation. Primarily, that would be by Indian offenders, whether members of the Yurok tribe or other tribes. And in California and Oregon as well, the United States Congress passed a federal law which gave the states jurisdiction over crimes in Indian country as well. And so that's a little bit different than the situation was in Oklahoma. We already have and have for, 60 so years, the situation with the state having criminal jurisdiction in Indian country.
So, Greg Oblovsky, let's come in there with Public Law 280. Why did it exist in the first place, and why is it different for California and Oregon and a handful of other states?
Well, back in the 50s, Congress decided it was going to try to devolve its trust responsibility to tribes down to the states. In other words, try to pass this responsibility to the states, and often in an unfunded mandate, in other words, without giving any money, it just told states that they had to take over this responsibility, including California and Oregon. So this was part of an era known as termination, in which the federal government was trying to do as little as possible for tribes, and the law has remained on the books since then, with lots of challenges in the way that it actually functions and operates.
All right. So why did Oregon and California and those other states get a different status under the law than the rest of the country?
It's a little unclear as to how exactly they made that determination. There are six so-called mandatory states in which Congress passed along this jurisdiction. There was some sense that these, based on the history, it seems like Congress thought that those were the states where Native peoples were economically more self-sufficient, where there were large numbers of Native peoples, and where the states were best equipped to take over these law enforcement responsibilities.
All right, so given that status, Judge Abby, does the Supreme Court ruling in Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta change anything for a tribal land in either state?
I think what it does is indicate the court's willingness to attack the tribes and attack jurisdiction, and that's what is worrying us, and I believe what in large part motivated us to join in with the tribes in Oklahoma, and I think join in correctly. You know, this is something that we do not want to encourage as we're trying to set up and establish our own systems, to have this jumbling of jurisdiction and this change, and basically saying, yeah, we agreed that we would take this responsibility or you would have this responsibility, but now we don't want to do that anymore. and that's often what underlies their decision making, you know, or we want to take this away from you, or we can do a better job, and frankly, they're not doing a better job.
And so, Don Baum, the Yurok tribe did file an amicus curiae brief with several other tribes in that case, Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta, to argue that Congress alone has the authority to determine who exercises criminal jurisdiction in Indian country. Lay out the thinking there.
We wanted to support other tribes and other states in their efforts to support tribal sovereignty. And so in some part, we're able to express our experience with state jurisdiction and how, you know, adding another sovereign into the mix doesn't necessarily, you know, fix all the law and order problems. Some of that comes from the fact that the Bureau of Indian Affairs generally doesn't fund tribal law enforcement and tribal courts in Public Law 280 states. So not only did the states get an unfunded mandate, but also the tribes who have concurrent jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction, are also underfunded. And many tribes are, of course, located in rural and remote areas where law enforcement is difficult for everyone, whether it's the tribe or states. It's hard to recruit. It's hard to cover large land areas in remote areas. And so our experience is, you know, this just isn't a magic bullet that will, you know, solve all of our law and order problems. We can see that with the fact that Northern California has such high rates of murdered and missing Indigenous people, and we're in a Public Law 280 state where states have criminal jurisdiction, and we're still having that problem. And so it hasn't been this wonderful fix that some folks think it might be, and that, you know, the current Supreme Court seems to think, okay, we'll just add another sovereign in there, and that'll be great. Our experience on the ground is it just hasn't turned out that way.
We're talking about justice, law, and order on tribal lands with two representatives of the Yurok tribe and a law professor at Stanford University. That is Greg Oblowski from the Yurok tribe. You just heard Don Baum, the director of the Office of the Yurok Tribal Attorney. And Yurok Chief Justice Abby Abinanti is with us as well. And you can join the conversation on the exchange, your thoughts, your questions, your comments on a fairly complicated issue that we'll try to refine down to some on-the-ground sorts of concepts as we go along here. But you can join us at 800-838-3760. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Judge Abby, the issue raised in the brief filed by the tribe with the Supreme Court says that that PL 280 states, Public Law 280 states, have not put enough funding into their law enforcement responsibilities. And we've talked several times now about unfunded mandates. So is the state able to provide much help to the Yurok tribe?
Well, they have the jurisdiction, and the problem is that in the rural counties in California, this is a huge geographic area. They are underfunded for their population, and adding in another population without any funding has just worsened, if that's a word, the situation. You know, you can't, law enforcement is a very expensive civic responsibility, and they were not given any funding to do that, and we were left in a position where we had to raise money separately, and we're not given any funding. And it just doesn't work that way. And I think that's what Don was saying. You know, it isn't that they're refusing to do it, it's that they can't meet their own responsibilities, much less look at us and go, okay, we're going to add in this other hugely, you know, geographic area and try to provide services there. It just doesn't work like that.
Well, there's an argument in the brief that Congress is actively engaged in addressing the crisis of violence against Native Americans. From your perspective, Judge Abby, through what efforts and what funding sources?
I think that that's the issue, you know, that whenever you have somebody trying to create a solution that's thousands of miles away from you and doesn't build from the ground up, you're going to have mismatched results, and that's what you have here. Now, you have 110 tribes, unrecognized tribes, and urban people in this state. in California itself. We have the largest population of Native people of any state. And that requires special treatment. You can't just go, oh, we're going to do something in D.C., we're going to set up some new rules, or we're going to shift the jurisdiction. That's not a magic bullet, and I think that's what Don was saying, that it doesn't work that way. You know, this needs on-the-ground solutions and on-the-ground resources.
And who should those logically come from the state, from the federal government?
I think the federal government actually created this void for the states and did not at all make any attempt to address it. You know, and I think the states have shouldered a burden for all these years between, you know, Public Law 280's passage and now, and it's just getting increasingly difficult to shoulder.
So what is the position of the tribe on the viability of Public Law 280? Does it want out from under? Should it not be there? Should California be exempted from it?
No, that would probably be a better question for Don, really.
Okay.
Because it's not something, I think it's something everyone's discussing, mm-hmm. you know, but it's really something that the council, which is represented by her office, would have to make a decision about. Mm-hmm.
So, Don, take that up. Is there a tribal position on Public Law 280 itself?
I don't know that our tribal council has, passed any formal position on that. I think, in general, everyone can understand that local communities, including tribes, having control of their own territory and the crimes within their territory makes sense. We have a tribal court led by Judge Abbey that is culturally based. It's very responsive. Most of our tribal members feel more comfortable there. They have a better sense of what to expect and how things are going to proceed and an understanding that it's going to be fair. And as much as, you know, my own personal position, which, may not officially be that of the tribe, tribes should have authority over their own territories. I think that transition to get rid of Public Law 280 comes down to the same problems of resources and, supporting tribes enough that they are ready to take those over. And tribes are in various states of being ready for that. We did talk in the brief that we signed on to about the Violence Against Women's Act, and that's specifically centered on domestic violence against women and children, and has some provisions giving tribes jurisdiction over even non-Indians, which is unique in Indian country, and we're working towards being able to implement that in our tribal system and tribal court. So that's sort of a step towards maybe a more full jurisdiction coming back to the tribe, more exclusive jurisdiction coming back to the tribe, and something we're taking steps towards. As complicated as the problem is, it's also complicated to fix it. We can't just snap our fingers and say, okay, state, you're out of here, and we're 100% ready to take everything up without more funding and more resources here on the ground.
So the passage of, or the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, Greg Oblowski, it was passed before the Oklahoma versus Castro decision handed down by the Supreme Court. Does the passage of the law or the reauthorization of Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, potentially set up a collision with the results of the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, in a formal sense, no, because the decision just laid on another sovereign. So there could be situations where actually someone could be prosecuted by all three sovereigns, tribe, state, and the federal government, for committing a crime in Indian country. So formally, no, it doesn't create that challenge, but I do think it reinforces the sense that the court really stepped into a situation where it wasn't needed. In other words, Congress was already actively involved in working on the challenges of law and order in Indian country. And the court just disregarded that and decided that it knew better than Congress how to fix this problem, and did so by dramatically upending the existing legal framework. So I do think the Violence Against Women Act shows one way that actually these sorts of problems are best addressed by, as both Don and Judge Abinanti pointed to, people who are the tribes themselves working on the ground. And the court just disregarded all of that and sort of inserted itself in the process and said, we unelected judges, we are best equipped to make this decision about the jurisdictional framework.
It's interesting you have that perception of it, because obviously in Dobbs versus Women's Health Center, the justices said we need to defer to the political branches, and you say they're doing the opposite here.
Well, they've been a little inconsistent about when they think the political branches are best equipped and when the court is best equipped, right? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, just before Dobbs, they handed down Bruin, in which they said Dobbs, they handed on Bruin and said, no, actually, you, the states, are out of the business of making gun laws in many instances, right? But the Constitution restricts you from making these decisions. So the court has vacillated a little bit on that particular question.
All right, we're talking about tribal justice here in the Jefferson Exchange with Greg Oblofsky, a law professor at Stanford University. Two representatives from the Yurok tribe are with us. Don Baum is the director of the Office of the Yurok Tribal Attorney, and Abby Abinanti is the Yurok Tribal Chief Justice. You're welcome to join us on the exchange with your questions, your comments, your observations. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark and Merlin. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, good morning. This topic is of great interest to me. Having studied about the Tacoma here, that's my main job. In 1953, I'm going to say his name was Anthony B. Watkins, a senator. For ideological reasons, led the congressional hearings, which were trying to come to an agreement that would allow termination of tribal rights. I'm wondering if we can identify an equal antagonist today in Congress so that we might address letters, emails, or whatever to try to get Congress on board with the idea that this shouldn't happen again.
Greg Oblofsky, is there one person in Congress who is best equipped to handle the input?
I would say no. There's not one antagonist in the way that there was with Senator Watkins. There are discussions, I think, ongoing about what a legislative Castro Huerta fix would look like. In other words, Congress is contemplating the possibility of overturning this decision through legislation. And hopefully when that legislation comes forward and is put on the table, that will be a moment when people can speak to their congressional representatives and urge passage of such a law.
All right. Arthur V. Watkins, I did have a chance to check it up, was influential in terminating federal recognition of American tribes, which is part of the issue that we're dealing with here. Judge Abby, bring this all the way back around to where we started, which was missing and murdered indigenous women. Talk about the complications of the moment and how the Yurok tribe is moving ahead.
Well, the complications of the moment are that the rural areas that we're located in do not have the resources needed or the protocols in place to handle searches in an expeditious manner. And the systems for alert systems are not interfacing or interlocking. So each system has kind of gone forward on its own, and we're working very hard to coordinate those and to create a response regionally that allows us to have resources to go into the field and conduct searches in an extremely rural area and to try to provide aid. So we're looking to resolve our problem by building up our resources. That's not going to be the end-all to end-all, because, one, we have to work with the partnerships, we have to assist them, and we're also in a situation where we have a number of tribes in the state, you know, and how are we going to help our neighbors and be good justice partners, not just tribal neighbors, but everyone who's involved here. So it's a terribly under-resourced area.
Is there some overlapping then? I mean, given that there are some neighboring tribes to the Yurok, are there some efforts to work together in the way you're talking about?
We're certainly trying to do that. When you were mentioning the declaration of our council, that declaration came out of a situation where there was a missing person who was actually enrolled in a neighboring tribe, but descendant from this tribe also. I mean, we're closely related.
All right. So there is Don Baum. It seems like there's a legislative framework advocated by the tribe within California. What kinds of things are you seeking for from the state, and are the legislators receptive?
There's a few different initiatives we are working on for law enforcement. One of them is legislation that would allow our tribal law enforcement officers to be recognized as sworn police officers under state law. That would give them access to some of the state databases and, you know, allow them to enforce more state law within Indian Country. In addition, Assemblymember James Ramos here in California has a bill creating a feather alert. So you might be familiar with Amber Alerts or Silver Alerts when vulnerable people are missing and at risk. And so this would create a special alert for those murdered and missing Indigenous people and help coordinate, you know, across jurisdictions and get the word out. And so those are a couple of the initiatives we've been working on.
All right. So problem of people, enough people and resources and money to go around, but also problem of jurisdictions. Greg Oblofsky, has this gotten just that much more complicated because of the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, we just don't know yet. The Supreme Court has created further complexity, further uncertainty around these questions. And, you know, complexity and uncertainty rarely end up working out particularly well for people on the ground. I think the research in this area has shown that tribes are the sovereign that is best equipped to try to secure justice within Indian Country. And so overlaying more state or more federal jurisdiction is not always the ideal solution. And so the Supreme Court has just stepped in and made an already complicated situation more complicated. And we're going to see how that plays out over the next few years. I mean, I think the experience of tribes with Public Law 280, like Yurok, as both Don and Judge Avenanti were pointing to, has not been particularly encouraging. So we'll see how things play out in the future.
All right. I can see we'll have to schedule a different session to talk about the Year 3 report on missing and murdered Indigenous people in Northern California. That'll come up in the future. Judge Abbey, Don Baum, and Greg Oblofsky, thank you all for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.